Welcome, everyone, to today's podcast of Personal Growth Recipes with your host, Ron Dener. This is going to be the second part of a two-part series on the 80-20 principle and how it applies to our lives. In today's podcast, I'm going to explore how we can apply the 80-20 principle to live, hopefully, a happier life. I'm also going to give a couple of illustrations of how the 80-20 principle applies to couple of subjects that most people are interested in today: money and our healthcare system. This is really simply to show how understanding the 80-20 principle can be used to help solve some of our most pressing everyday needs and problems. Let's begin. Aristotle said that the goal of all human activity should be happiness. Now, down through the ages, we really haven't listened much to Aristotle. Perhaps he should have told us how to be happier. Now, he could have started by analyzing the causes of unhappiness and happiness. Can the 80-20 principle really apply to happiness? I believe it can. It appears to be true for most people that the majority of perceived happiness occurs in a majority of the time. One 80-20 hypothesis would be that 80% of happiness occurs in about 20% of our time. What I have observed is that about two-thirds of people fall into this category. About 80% of their happiness happens in about 20% of their time. Now, the other one-third don't exhibit the 80-20 pattern. Their happiness is much more equally distributed over time. And what's really fascinating is that this one-third group of people seems to be markedly happier overall than the two-thirds group of people whose happiness peaks in small amounts of their lives. This really fits with common sense. Those who are happy with most of their lives are more likely to be happier overall. And those whose happiness is highly concentrated in short bursts are likely to be less happy with life overall. There's two ways to be happier. Two ways. Number one, identify the times when you're the happiest and really try to expand on them as much as possible. Identify the times when you are least happy and reduce them as much as possible. Start by cutting off those valleys, what I call those valleys of unhappiness. Those things that tend to make you actively unhappy. The best way to start being more happy is to stop being unhappy. Easier said than done, right? You and I have more control over this than we could imagine, simply by avoiding situations where experience suggests that you're likely to become unhappy. For activities that make you unhappy, try to think of ways that you could enjoy them more. If this works, fine. If it doesn't, think of how to avoid these situations altogether. We can make ourselves happier by changing the way we think about ourselves. Do you think of yourself as successful or unsuccessful? If you opt for unsuccessful, you may be sure that there's many people that have achieved less than you have and would be really described by most people as less successful than you are. You see, their perception of self-success contributes both to their success and their happiness. Your feeling of being unsuccessful really limits your success and your happiness. Make the choice that you want to be happy. You owe it to yourself. Psychologists tell us that all perceptions about happiness relate to our sense of self-worth. A positive self-image is really essential to happiness. A sense of self-worth can and should be cultivated. You know you can do it. Just what we got to do is we have to give up guilt, forget about your weaknesses, and focus and build on your strengths. Just try to remember all the good things that you've done, all those small and big achievements to your credit, all the positive feedback you've ever received. There's a lot to be said for yourself. Say it, or at least think it. You're going to be amazed at the difference it makes to your relationships, your achievements, and your happiness. You might feel that you're deceiving yourself, but in fact, by having a negative perception of yourself, you're at least as guilty of self-deception. All the time that we tell ourselves stories about ourselves, all the time we're always telling stories ourselves. Stories about ourselves. So you might as well choose positive rather than negative stories. And by doing so, you're going to increase the sum of human happiness, starting with yourself and radiating out to other people. What you want to do is you want to use all the willpower at your disposal to make yourself happy. And really construct the right stories about yourself and really try to believe them. We can also make ourselves happier by changing the people that we see most. There's medical evidence that high levels of stress can be coped with provided that we have a few excellent personal relationships. But relationships of any kind that take up a large part of our time and are part of the fabric of our lives, whether at home or at work or in our social lives, will really powerfully influence both our happiness and our health. It's really the most important relationships in your life, the people that you see day in and day out, that really seem to be crucial for your health. And the more significant the relationship in your life, the more it matters for your health. Just stop and think. Think about the people you see every day. Do they make you happy or less happy? Could you change the amount of time you spend with them accordingly? I'm going to talk about seven daily happiness habits. Happiness only exists now. Past happiness may be remembered, or future happiness planned, but the pleasure this gives can only be experienced in the now. What we really need is a set of daily happiness habits. I want to share these seven daily happiness habits. Okay. Number one is exercise. One essential ingredient of a happy day is physical exercise. You know, I always feel good during and after exercise. Apparently, this is because exertion releases endorphins, those natural antidepressants that are really similar to exhilarating drugs, but with none of the dangers or the side effects. And daily exercise is really an essential habit. If you don't make it a habit, you will do it far less than you should. Personally, I try to exercise early in the morning before things get real busy. And what you want to do is you want to customize an exercise schedule that really fits your personal time schedule. Try to pick a consistent time of day to do it as close to every day as possible. My wife and I travel a lot, and I exercise when I travel. You know, I even check to see if a facility has a gym. If not, I'll take my own portable equipment with me. It's a big deal. Okay. Number two is mental stimulation. Now you may not obtain this at work, but if not, excuse me, you may obtain this at work. Okay, but if not, and just ensure that there is some intellectual or mental exercise each day. There's a huge number of ways to do this depending on your interests. I'll give you some examples. They can include simple things like crossword puzzles, certain magazines, newspapers, reading part of a book, talking for at least 20 minutes to an intelligent friend about an abstract topic, writing a short article or journal entry, or just watching television if it's educational. Number three is what I call spiritual or artistic stimulation. All that's required is about 30 minutes for the imagination or the spirit, okay? Going to a concert, an art gallery, theater, movie, these all qualify, as do just going out watching the sunrise or the sunset, looking at the stars, reading out of the Bible, or going to a church event. Meditation also works well. Number four is doing something for another person or people. Now, this doesn't have to be a major work of benevolence. It can be a random act of kindness, just simply such as greeting a person with a big smile and a wave. Number five is to share a pleasurable break with a friend. This should be uninterrupted for at least 30 minutes, maybe just a cup of coffee or wine or a leisurely walk. Number six is to give yourself a treat. Now, to prompt you each day, write down a list of all the pleasures in which you could indulge yourself. Don't worry, you don't have to show the list to anybody. Just try to ensure that you can chalk up at least one of these each day. Number seven is at the end of each day, just congratulate yourself on having followed your daily happiness habits. Since the point is to make yourself happy rather than unhappy, you can count of score a five or more, including this number seven, as a success, okay? If you haven't notched up five habits, but still have achieved something significant or enjoyed yourself, just congratulate yourself anyway on a day's worthwhile living. So let's now shift over to talk about seven shortcuts to a happy life. Seven shortcuts to a happy life. Number one is to maximize control over your life. You see, lack of control is the root cause of much unease and uncertainty. I would rather drive a long way around a complex city route with which I am familiar than try to navigate a potentially shorter course that I don't know where I'm going. You know, I think one of the most frustrating jobs would be to me to drive a bus in a larger city. You know, the bus driver has little control over the route that they must take each day, and when the bus moves, that would be frustrating. This is kind of, to me, similar to working in a large bureaucracy, which really leads to alienation because, you know, one's working life just can't be controlled. I would personally go nuts if I had to do this. You know, self-employed people who can determine their working hours and work scheduling are usually happier than employed people who cannot. Maximizing the proportion of your life under your own control is going to require some planning and risk-taking, though. But the happiness dividends, as I call them, are really, you don't want to underestimate them. Number two is setting reasonable and attainable goals. You know, research has shown that we're likely to achieve most when we have really reasonably challenging but not too difficult goals. Objectives that are too easy are just going to lead us to be complacent and just accept mediocre performance. But objectives that are too tough, that give us maybe guilt or unrealistic expectations, they're just demoralizing. They're just going to lead to self-fulfilling, you know, self-perceptions of failure. Just remember that you're trying to become happier. If in doubt, when setting yourself goals for yourself, try to err on the soft side. It's better for your happiness to set soft goals and succeed than it is to set tough goals and fail. If there's a trade-off between achievement and happiness, choose happiness. Number three is be flexible when chance events interfere with plans and expectations. You see, I say life is what happens while we're making other plans. We must be prepared for life to really to insert its quota of objections and diversions. It's going to happen. Life's interjections should be cheerfully and playfully accepted as a counterpoint to our plans. We just need to factor it in when we're making plans. We don't want to let life's objections ruffle us or make us angry, self-doubting, or bitter. Just remember that. Number four is develop a close relationship with a happy partner. Now, we're programmed to develop a close living relationship with one person. You know, the selection of the one partner is one of the few decisions in life that's going to determine whether we're happy or not. This definitely falls under the 20% category of the 80-20 principle. If you've not yet selected a partner, just remember that your happiness is going to be greatly influenced by the happiness of your partner. Be wise. Pick one. Pick a good one. For the sake of your happiness as well as for your love, you're going to want to make your partner happy. But this will be a great deal easier if your partner has, to start with, a happy temperament. And he or she has some of these daily happiness habits I talked about earlier. You know, team up with an unhappy partner and the odds are that you yourself are going to end up unhappy. If you're a very happy person, you just might make an unhappy person happy. But it's a hell of a trick to pull off, okay? Two unhappy people, even in love, are going to drive each other nuts. If you want to be happy, choose to love a happy partner. Number five is to cultivate close friendships with a few happy friends. The 80-20 principle predicts that most of the satisfaction that you and I draw from all your friends will be concentrated really in your close relationship with a small number of close friends. The principle also indicates that you're likely to spend too much time with the not-so-good friends and too little time with the very good friends. So the answer is to decide who the good friends are and to give them 80% of the time allocated to friends, because they're going to be a great source of mutual happiness. Number six is to develop strong professional alliances, really with a small number of people whose company you enjoy. You know, not all your work or professional colleagues should really become your friends. You know, if so, you would spread your friendships too thinly. But a few should become close friends and allies, people whom you will go out of your way to support, and they'll do the same for you. And this will not only enhance your career, it'll also really enrich the pleasure that you get at work. It's going to prevent you from feeling alienated at work, and it will really provide a unifying link between what I call your work and your play. This unity, too, is essential, really essential for full happiness. Number seven is to evolve the lifestyle that you and your partner want. This is going to require a harmonious balance between your work life, your home life, and your social life. It means that you live where you want to work. You have the quality of life that you want. You have the time to attend to family and social affairs and are equally happy at work and outside of it. Now, the key to achieving this is for you and your partner to have open and honest communication. And what I've learned, it's a lifelong process, but well worth it. You know, happiness is a duty. We should choose to be happy. And we should really work at happiness. And in doing so, we should help those closest to us. And even those that we just stumble across, you know, just to share our happiness. The 80-20 principle does apply to every area of our life and everyday issues that we have to deal with, really, as a society. You know, I want to shift over now. I want to use two random topics to illustrate what I mean. The first topic is money. Most people have really, really peculiar views about money. They really think it's more important than it is, but they also think it's more difficult to get than it is. Since most people want to have more money than they currently have, let's deal with the second point first. My view is that money is not difficult to obtain, and once you have even a little of it to spare, it's really not difficult to multiply. How do you obtain money in the first place? Well, the best answer, one that really works surprisingly well, is just to do something you enjoy. Now, the logic, here's the logic behind that. It runs like this. If you enjoy something, that you're likely to be good at it, and you're likely to be better at it than things that you don't enjoy. If you're good at something, you can create something that's going to satisfy other people. And if you satisfy other people, they're going to generally pay you well for it. And since most people don't do things that they enjoy, they will not be as productive as you are. And you're going to be able to earn above the going rate in your vocation. This is one of the hidden gems of advice that can propel you really forward in your career, especially if you decide to go into business for yourself. You know, I've been in the insurance sales for over 33 years, and when I started, my main concern was the amount of competition in this field. But what I've discovered, many people in sales experience burnout after several years in the frontline trenches, and several others decide to coast and just put it on cruise control after several years. And what I've discovered, if you're willing to outwork others and just stay consistent, it turned out not to be nearly as competitive as I originally envisioned. You know, your number one competitor is actually yourself. This is why 20% of the people in sales make 80% of the money, by the way. What if what you enjoy most has a poor employment market? Okay, let's talk about that. Then really, all I can tell you is just go to your next most preferred vocation and repeat this process really until you find one that you like and pays well. This may not be for everybody, okay? Once in your profession, if making money is really important to you, and if you're any good at what you do, you should aim at trying to become self-employed as soon as possible. And after that, depending on what your ambitions are, to start to employ other people. 80% of the value in any organization or profession comes from 20% of the professionals. The workers who are above average will tend to be paid more than those who are below average, but nowhere near enough to reflect the difference in performance. So it follows that the best people are always underpaid and the worst people are always overpaid. Now, as an above average employee, you cannot escape from this trap. Sorry. Your boss may think you are good, but you're never going to get credit for your true value relative to others. Unfortunately, this is one of the greatest frustrations of being an employee. And I'll tell you the truth, the only way out of it is to just set up a business for yourself. And if you're so inclined to employ other people, above average people, fact of life. Don't take either as... here's once again a word of caution. Don't take either of these steps, however, if you're not comfortable with being self-employed or a boss. Okay? One last thing about money. Money can buy you happiness, but only to the extent that you use money to do what is really right for you in the first place. You see, money is just a magnifier. If you're a really good person, more money is going to make you a bigger, really good person. If you're a jerk, more money is just going to make you a bigger jerk. Now, here's an interesting principle. The more money you have, the less value an extra dollar of wealth creates. Now, stay with me on this. In economic language, the marginal utility of money declines sharply. It's a fancy statement. Let me break that down. Once you've adjusted to a higher standard of living, it may give you little or no extra happiness. I got news for you, okay? It could even turn negative if the extra cost of maintaining this new lifestyle causes anxiety or piles on extra pressure to earn money in non-satisfying ways. You know, the tax authorities also make making more money inefficient. You earn more and you pay disproportionately more in taxes. That's called life. Earn more, work more, and you have to spend more on living close to work in an inexpensive metropolitan area or alternatively on commuting. Spend more and you have to work more. It really can become a vicious cycle. Just be aware of it. Be aware of it. You know, you can end up with an expensive lifestyle that controls you rather than vice versa. You really might get much better value and happiness out of a simpler and cheaper lifestyle. So that's your call on that, okay? Let's talk about the second topic, our broken healthcare system. You know, right now in the United States, there's a great debate over how to pay for our health care. One side wants to spend a higher proportion of our national wealth on health care, primarily through higher taxes. The other side wants to limit tax increases and try to ensure that subsidized health care is only available to those most in need. There's little common ground in this debate. But if we ask which side the 80-20 principle would take, the answer is neither. You know, 2 decades ago, the U.S. Surgeon General very sensibly tried to attribute the cause of illness and concluded that only 10% of it was attributable to medical care or its absence. Very important statement there. 50% of it was related to personal behavior. Yet, our U.S. budgets have allocated 20 times more spending to corrective medical care than to all the programs encouraging better nutrition, health education, self-care medication, and personal fitness. The 80-20 principle just simply asserts that about 20% of expenditure will generate 80% of desired results and vice versa. Progress depends on identifying that 20% that yields 80% and the 80% that yields 20%. In this case, the 20% that leads to 80 plainly includes health education, particularly that's targeted in the early stages when it can have the most effect. In the case of healthcare, you know, prevention is better and a great deal cheaper than cure. Stopping disease in the early stages is much better than stopping it later. That's just common sense. You know, creating habits of healthy living among the young, habits that are likely to endure throughout a lifetime, will do way more good than almost any other form of social expenditure. To me, it would be sensible to really devote truly massive energies to health education in schools where it really shifts behavior. In my opinion, it would make sense for our government to create, supervise, and monitor programs to ensure major steps forward in healthy eating and exercise. I would go so far as I would even suggest using private sector marketing firms and paying them by results. We probably need fewer hospitals, fewer doctors, and fewer nurses. We probably need more voluntary and home-based health workers, more nutritionists, more gyms, and more fitness equipment. You see, our society is treating the symptom and not the disease in this case. My purpose in sharing the healthcare issue is to illustrate, just to illustrate how applying the 80-20 principle can move the discussion to actually trying to fix the underlying problem. The greatest thing about the 80-20 principle is that you do not need to wait for everybody else. You know, you can start to practice it in your professional and personal life. You can multiply your highs and cut out most of your lows. You can become a better, more useful, and happier human being. And you can help others do the same. So this concludes today's podcast of Personal Growth Recipes. You know, this subject I truly, truly enjoyed, the 80-20, the Pareto Principle. I hope you got something out of it. And I really, really enjoy that whole concept of what it stands for. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to like, share, and leave a comment down below. I invite you to follow me on Twitter at Ron Denner. Follow me on Instagram at Denner Ron. Subscribe to my YouTube channel, Ron Denner. I invite you to subscribe to Personal Growth Recipes on Apple Podcasts. And please give us a 5-star rating if you've been enjoying it. And like and share our Facebook page at facebook.com/personalgrowthrecipes. And I'll announce my next podcast. We're not sure yet if it's going to be Personal Growth Recipes or Biz Connections next Wednesday. I'll announce it for you with Saturday's 2-Minute Drill, so stay tuned, okay? And I really enjoyed this episode. This is Ron Denner, your host for Personal Growth Recipes, serving up and signing off.